3. Seattle defeated the White Sox 3-0. Checking the schedule, the Brewers wrap up their series against the Rockies this afternoon. The Mariners and White Sox play late this afternoon, and the Cubs host the Reds again tonight. Now, the forecast from the National Weather Service, a couple more dry days, sunshine today, a high of 77. Normal high for this time of year is 77. Clear skies tonight, a low of 59. Sunny, warmer tomorrow, a high of 81. The five-day weather trend, the next chance for rain coming up Saturday night into Sunday. Temperatures holding in the low 80s until Sunday, when the high is expected to plummet to the lower 70s. Currently, we have sunshine, a temperature reading of 66. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get to today's interview, I want to mention a change in plan for tomorrow's morning show. After we had laid out the schedule for the week, it was brought to my attention that tomorrow is International Literacy Day. And so in honor of that, I'm excited to welcome to the program tomorrow Cheryl Hernandez, who is Executive Director of the Kenosha Literacy Council. And also joining us will be Marcia Connick, formerly a staff member here at WGTD. She is the Southeast Representative for Wisconsin Literacy. And with them, we will celebrate International Literacy Day tomorrow on the morning show. And the previously scheduled program, an author interview with David Stashower, author of American Demon, that interview will air next week instead. All right, on to the Wednesday Morning Show here on WGTD. I remember growing up as a youngster with something on my bedroom bookshelf called Childcraft, which came from the World Book Encyclopedia Company. And in one of those volumes, they told various stories about different important figures in history. And they told a story of a little girl who grew up fascinated by the instruments in her father's laboratory, and in particular a glass case which was forbidden to her, but it had all kinds of interesting things in it, and she was absolutely fascinated. And one day, as the story was told in this book, she could not resist her fascination any longer, opened the thing up, began handling the items, and something went crashing to the floor as her father walked in. She was so frightened, but he scooped her up in his arms and reassured her that it was fine. And this was a somewhat fictionalized, yet nonetheless very compelling telling of an early moment in the life of Marie Curie, Madame Curie, who went on to become one of the most important scientists the world has ever seen, she and her husband working together at a time when it was not at all common for women to be involved at all in the field of science, let alone to such a remarkable extent. Well, I have to say that story I read so many years ago in Childcraft has always left me curious about Madame Curie, but I have not done anything about it until recently, when across my desk came a wonderful book called Obsessive Genius, The Inner World of Marie Curie, part of a series called Great Discoveries, published by W.W. Norton. And with me on the phone for the next few minutes is Barbara Goldsmith, a best-selling author many times over, including Little Gloria, Happy at Last, The Straw Man, Other Powers, The Age of Suffrage, and many other books. She is an award-winning author many times over, and the author of this book, which really helps unlock for us extraordinary achievements of Marie Curie, and also which helps to peel away some of the mystery and misunderstandings which have surrounded her professional and personal lives. Barbara Goldsmith, we welcome you to the morning show.
I'm glad to be here.
And I am so glad that you have written this fascinating book. Let's begin for just a moment with the most basic sort of thing, which might not be common knowledge to all of our listeners, although I think many people know the name Marie Curie. Many people don't have any idea why she was as important as she was. Just summarize briefly, if you would, her achievements.
Well, Marie Curie, in fact, opened the door to all of 20th century science because she discovered what radioactive waves were and what radioactivity could do. For example, when she started, France imported 90% of its energy, and by the time she finished, France got all of its energy homemade through radioactivity and atomic energy, and even exported energy. That's just one example. But the big thing was that I mean, why another book on Marie Curie? There have been so many, like the one that you, Greg, read as a child. Well, the answer is that I had access to papers that were sealed for three quarters of a century, her diaries, her workbooks. No one had seen these for over three quarters of a century. And in those books are Marie Curie, the person, what she was feeling, what she was dealing with as a woman, her love affairs, everything that we've never heard. So obsessive genius, the inner world of Marie Curie, is really all fresh material, except for giving a brief background.
Let's talk for a moment about the way in which you accessed this material. You say in the acknowledgments that none of these Curie papers are easy to access at all. Just tell us the kind of thing you had to go through in order to see these wonderful things.
Well, the main thing to remember is the reason one couldn't access them was that they were radioactive. Marie Curie died of radium poisoning, and these were radioactive papers. And if you wanted, for example, to go into a sealed vault, you would have to sign a medical release. 3 years ago, Marie Curie's granddaughter took these papers to her university at Orsay. She is also a very good physicist, and she decontaminated them. And when they came back to the Bibliothèque Nationale, I hopped on a plane, and there I was trying to get access to them. As you said, it wasn't easy. They were in the public domain, but the catch-22 was that I had to have a letter from a direct Curie relation in order to read them. Try to figure that out. They're in the public domain, but you can't read them. Finally, I asked Hélène, the granddaughter, to write me such a letter. She refused because she said they were in the public domain. So I just sat there for a while not knowing what to say, and then I said, well, would you write me a note that I don't need a note? And we both broke up, and she called the bibliothèque, and that was my access, and I was there for about 4 months researching these papers.
Wow. What a thrill that must have been. You know, not long ago, I had the opportunity to speak with one of the world-renowned experts of the Dead Sea Scrolls and spoke with her about her experience of actually being able to edit the Dead Sea Scrolls and to work with them. And I have a feeling that although it's we're not talking about anything quite so ancient, that it has to be a similar sort of thrill to have before you materials which have never been extensively studied before, and many which have hardly been seen by human eyes since the death of Marie Curie.
Yes, well, her daughter, Ev Curie, wrote a book about her in 1935, and that book was really interesting, but it wasn't what I call a warts and all profile, because she left out Marie Curie's love affairs, the fact that after Pierre died, she had a passionate affair with a married scientist and was nearly driven out of France. They stoned her house. They called her a Polish whore. I mean, it was terrible and indicative of the sexual attitudes of the time, in that the man involved, nothing happened to him. They thought he was quite virile and interesting. He had many mistresses. So all of this was not in her daughter's book, understandably. And, you know, I have, I think, everything, her love letters, her workbook entries, and I really think the thing that perhaps I did well is it's a hell of a story. It's a real yarn, don't you think?
Absolutely. We're speaking with Barbara Goldsmith, and her book is called Obsessive Genius, The Inner World of Marie Curie. She is influenced, certainly, by the fact that she grew up, first of all, in an age when science was just beginning to stir itself into some truly exciting developments, but also the fact that she grew up in the home of a scientist. Give us some sense of what her father, a Polish scientist, was all about, and the influence which he had on her life's path.
Well, the first surprise for me was that Marie Curie was not French. She was Polish. Her name was Mania Sladowska, and she was brought up in Warsaw in a time when Poland technically did not exist. It was taken over by the Russians, and she had to go to school in Russian. She had to write in Russian, and she hated it. Her father was a great Polish patriot, and the Russians discovered that when he taught physics, he was also trying to teach Polish pride, Polish literature. So they fired him, and never again could he teach physics. And that's when all his equipment got locked in a glass case and never again was touched. But he had such ambition for his family. Marie's mother had tuberculosis, so she never really went near the children and died when Marie was quite young. And she writes in one of her notebooks, "I never felt a mother's caress." Her mother was afraid to go near her. Hmm. Her father pushed her and pushed her, and she became as obsessed with science as he had been. She worked his 8 years as a governess to earn enough money. They were very poor, in order to go to the Sorbonne in France, which was one of the few places that took women. There were 1,000 men, and Marie and 2 other women, and Marie graduated first in that class, and she was just fixated, obsessed, that's where I got the title, with becoming something, of making discoveries, and she didn't really care about anything else. She had a little garret room of her own, and she was essentially off to the races.
You talk about how, in the wake, especially of her mother's death, that death and a second important death that Marie Curie experienced what she herself called a profound depression. And this was something which was to be very much a recurring pattern. And apparently, you tell us, one of her means to deal with her depression would be losing herself in books and focusing away all outward distractions, which was a coping mechanism and also, I suppose, a means by which she could really even more further excel as a young budding scientist.
I think that's a great observation on your part. Today, we would call her a bipolar personality. She was all her life subject to severe depressions. And after she had her affair with Langevin, Paul Langevin, and they tried to deny her her second Nobel Prize as a result of this affair, she wrote a wonderful letter saying, "My work and my personal life have nothing to do with each other." Got her Nobel Prize, as you will read in Obsessive Genius, went home and collapsed and never came out of her room for a year after that. I mean, it's quite dramatic, her actual life, as opposed to this myth of the woman who did it all and had it all.
Yes, I was going to say that at some point you talk about Marie Curie often being remembered as a scientific Joan of Arc, that there is this myth that surrounds her, which, while properly acknowledging her brilliance as a scientist, in some respects masks some of the great, profound unhappiness that was also a part of who she was for nearly all of her life.
Yes, and I think that's very important, because she did accomplish all these things, but she was so human. She was coping with all the things that many women cope with today. Her husband died in a terrible accident when she was only 38, so she was a single mother. She never had enough money for years and years. Professionally, it was pretty much the way it is today. Perhaps you know Larry Summers at Harvard, who said women are not equipped as well as men for science. Perhaps they're genetically inferior. All of those things in spades existed when Marie Curie worked. And this virulent sexism, the idea that women should be beautiful and marry and reproduce and have lots of children and then die, was kind of what was happening then in France. And instead, I really think a human being with all her struggles and her glorious life, but also tragic life, emerges in this book.
Let's talk about her move from her native Poland to France. You've already touched on it. She studied at something called the Sorbonne.
Yes, the Sorbonne is the great university in Paris. It's still the great university in Paris. It's free. You can go for a degree or not, just as you wish. And it has produced perhaps all the great minds politically and scientifically in France. It was the school to go to. And she just saved her money, and she had a sister who lived in Paris, and the sister helped her, and she became a student at the Sorbonne. And that's where she made all her contacts of professors, some of whom saw her brilliance, but most of whom, once she became really famous, turned on her because they were so jealous.
You say that, like the parched earth, she soaked up education as a life-giving force. I mean, it's I suppose, a good thing that that she had the opportunity to be in the in a place like the Sorbonne. One thinks of other gifted women where this option was simply not open to them. Can you help us understand, you already mentioned that out of a couple of thousand students, there were only three women. How was it that Marie Curie found herself in such a tiny minority?
At that point, most universities, certainly every single university in Poland, did not admit women. They didn't think women needed to be educated. They didn't think women would ever take their place in the world of men, either in science or in politics or in business. They barred them from every university. It was only in Paris that was quite free-thinking that women could come at all. She wasn't the only scientist who experienced this. Liesel Meitner, who decoded artificial radioactivity and realized that people had split the atom and started the road to the atom bomb, really, along with Marie Curie. She had to hide under the seats in the lecture hall at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute because women were not allowed in the lecture halls. They were confined to the basement. They were confined to assistants' jobs. Just take women in science today and multiply it by about 1,000 in discrimination, and you'll have the kind of climate that Marie functioned in.
Which makes it all the more incredible that not only did she have the determination to get herself admitted to the Sorbonne, but then, as you say, at the end of that first year, when she takes the comprehensive exam and then lets herself into the amphitheater to hear the names read off in order of merit, her name is the very first one read. She finishes with the top score in that entire school. I mean, an amazing accomplishment.
That's all she cared about. She writes that she lived in a fifth-floor garret. The idea that she could buy herself a scuttle of coal was a real expenditure, so that was a real treat. Instead, she piled every bit of clothing she knew over her when it was freezing cold, and she writes that those were some of the happiest days of her life. She had, as Virginia Woolf wrote, a room of her own, and she could just immerse herself in science. And she said things like, science has great beauty, and science has a sense of adventure. And I think a lot of people have stripped that away today. But for me, it still does have that sense of adventure. And I think one of the things I did well in Obsessive Genius is that the science, anyone can understand. There's no jargon in what I write. I write exactly what she did and how she did it. And I have a very cute 14-year-old grandson who said, you know what? I understood this for the first time.
We're speaking with Barbara Goldsmith, and her book is Obsessive Genius, The Inner World of Marie Curie. One of the consequences of Marie Curie coming to study in France is that she meets another very talented scientist by the name of Pierre Curie, who, of course, will eventually become her husband. Tell us a little bit about the basic connection between these two. How did they find themselves to be soulmates?
Well, it's very interesting. People who have bought into the Marie Curie myth always say that this was the love at first sight affair. But indeed, it wasn't. Marie Curie went to Pierre Curie for two reasons. Her friend had told her that he had laboratory space, which she desperately needed for her experiments, and had told her that he could design great equipment so she could measure radioactive waves, which nobody else had been able to do. In fact, he didn't have a laboratory at all. He worked in a tiny cubbyhole. But he did design this equipment for her and found her a laboratory. And this equipment was remarkable for the day, particularly when you understand that what they used was so primitive, you know, plywood, pins, glue. He made an electrometer that measured these waves. He fell madly in love with her. He was still living at home in his 30s. He was a bachelor. He said, I'm really not interested. Women of genius are rare. That was what he said. But he met a woman of genius, and he fell madly in love with her. She was not in love with him. She wanted to go back to Warsaw and help her father with the Polish pride and so forth. And he wrote her wonderful letters that are in Obsessive Genius. And finally he said, okay, I will go to Poland with you. I'll learn Polish. And that way maybe we can achieve our scientific dream. And that sold her. She decided she'd marry him and she'd stay in France. Mm. And they used what little money they have to buy bicycles and went on a 2-month bike trip for a honeymoon. And by the time they came back, they were madly in love.
Mm.
But it wasn't exactly the way people have perceived it. It wasn't love at first sight. It was science at first sight.
You quote Pierre as saying that although he probably vacillated on every single thing in his whole life, this was one matter in which he did not vacillate. He was in love with Marie, and he was determined that one way or another they would end up together. And, of course, eventually they did. Tell us a bit more now about the kind of work which drew them together and had them working tirelessly side by side.
Well, Marie Curie used ore from which uranium had been removed. They removed the uranium to color Bohemian glass. Those beautiful glows on Bohemian glass were made by using uranium. And as she tested this ore, she found out that there was an element that was giving off even more energy than uranium. And it couldn't have been uranium because there was no uranium. So she determined that she would find that element. And it took her 4 years, 10 tons of this ore in an open courtyard, thousands of distillations, and she finally found pure radium. How much? Well, people in most of the books I read said it would have only filled a quarter of a teaspoon. Her granddaughter, who's a brilliant physicist, said that's a gross overestimation. It would have been about 8 grains of sand. And she just determined she would do it. Pierre's role, Pierre designed the equipment, and then when he saw that his wife was utterly exhausted, he went to a factory, a scientific factory, and he said, give us some assistance, and we will give you what we produce. We will give you part of what we produce. And that was the way she was able to work for 4 years. Otherwise, she would have been just, you know, totally exhausted.
Hmm. It's interesting. One of the things you talk about in some of this first work, which the husband and wife did, was the fact that not only did Marie Curie have to have incredible intelligence and inquisitiveness and imagination and that sort of thing, which I think we all understand is essential to the work of a scientist. But you also help us understand how it was also a physically taxing undertaking, at least the way this was done back then, as she worked with her husband's electrometer, that it took sleight of hand and just plain old concentration to sit at this device hour after hour, day after day, to make some of the discoveries which she did. That's the sort of hidden requirement of this kind of work, which would never occur to the rest of us thinking about it.
Oh, that's why I put it in the book. And when I did, my editor said, you know, when you describe how she sits there day after day after day, it's kind of a tedious description. You think you should cut it? And I said, oh, no, now you know why I put it in, because it's a tedious job. When I went to the Curie Institute, they had an original electrometer that Pierre had designed, and I said, and it's in Obsessive Genius, could you demonstrate this for me? And Hélène, her granddaughter, started to laugh, and she said, no, you know, there is no one who can demonstrate it. No one has the sleight of hand to hold the chronometer, the clock, in one hand, to put weights on a scale on the other hand, and to watch a beam of light on a mirror. Nobody can do that today.
Hmm, the way that Marie Curie could.
Exactly right.
Let's talk about another challenge which faced her, and that was the fact that she was not only a young scientist, but very, very quickly, she was also a young mother. Her first daughter was, I think, Irene, and then Ave comes a few years later. But she was coping, that is Marie Curie, with a heavy workload as a scientist and with the issue of child care, which you talk about.
Well, the things she was coping with are no different than today. She was coping first with having children and wanting desperately to do right by them, but to being obsessed with her career. She, after Pierre died in a horrible accident, which you will read about, she was a single mother, and that was very difficult. She never had enough money. She had to cope with jealousy and sexism and all of these things. And it's not very different from today. It's not very different from Larry Summers saying that women are not genetically, perhaps, equipped for science. There was little help, no, very few mentors. Nobody ever called on her in class. It was not a great situation. But she didn't see any obstacles. She just went for what she was going for. She was a virtuoso scientist. And I think that a lot of the books that depict her as cold and isolated don't understand her inner world at all. For example, Albert Einstein said that Marie Curie is cold as a herring. And she really wasn't, but she took that pose in order to just keep going with her science. And her daughters, who felt she was neglecting them in some way, when she died, they found every little letter, every picture, every note tied up in little bits of ribbon.
Mm. Wow. Well, eventually, she and her husband were able to complete the very hard work of isolating the element of radium. And you help us understand how scientists might believe that some sort of new element existed, but isolating it was a special challenge. But only when you isolated, then it become an absolute certainty that this element exists. Here it is.
Yes. Physicists believe there was a new element, but chemists have to see it. Chemists must see it. So she concluded that it existed in less than a year, but it took her 4 years to produce a substance where chemists could not say this was not an element. And there had been a chart of all the elements, and they filled in the one, it was called Mendeleev's chart, that had been discovered. And physicists knew that probably there was another element, and she knew it, but in order to fit it into that chart, she was determined that she would dispel all of this cynicism and actually give chemists a substance.
Hmm.
And later she spent another 3 years producing it as a pure metal, which existed in a quarter-inch square of pure metal. But it had to be then dismantled because it was just so expensive to keep it that way.
Mm. Well, this discovery, of course, leads to this extraordinary moment in the career of the Curies when they are awarded the Nobel Prize. But you remind us that initially the nomination for the Nobel Prize was for Pierre Curie and Henri Becquerel, a colleague, and Marie Curie was not even mentioned in that initial nomination. And it sounds like it was only after some time and some effort that Marie Curie was properly included and acknowledged with the Nobel Prize.
Yes, and had it not been for Pierre Curie saying, I can't get this prize, my wife did all the work, I only was the assistant in designing the equipment and making arrangements, I'm not accepting this prize, that people began to rally to Marie Curie. But even when she got her first Nobel Prize, she won two, but when she got her first Nobel Prize in 1903, she had to sit in the audience while Pierre sat on the dais. And when Pierre gave his Nobel speech, this kind of backfired because she wasn't prominent, and so he could, in his speech, say, this was my wife's discovery, I had very little to do with it. Henri Becquerel discovered these rays, but my wife measured them, she harnessed them, she realized that they could be used to generate enormous energy, and of course, they wanted enormous energy for peaceful means. And but he even recognized in 1903, he said, like Nobel, who invented dynamite, this could go two ways. It could be for good or for evil, and let's hope it's really for good.
Mm. It's interesting, too, you shed fascinating light on the whole phenomenon of fame. In fact, in the chapter following the Nobel Prize, the chapter is called The Disaster of Our Lives, and Pierre Curie calls this sudden fame for them a disaster, mostly because it ends up keeping them from continuing on with this very, very important work. You quote him, I believe it's him, or is it her, that say, clearly I've not yet discovered a means to defend ourselves against this frittering away of our time, which is nevertheless extremely necessary. Intellectually, it is a question of life or death.
And I think that that is something that even pertains today. It's universal. Somehow we love in our celebrity society to set up these people, and then when they're kind of icons on pedestals, to tear them down. And it happens again and again. It's the big CEO who we worship, and then there's a scandal. It's typical in the Martha Stewart case. We go on and on and on. And this setting up an icon and then tearing it down is a celebrity thing. And the other thing is that we begin, as in the case of Marie Curie, to create a kind of illusion that takes the place of reality. And you forget that these are real people trying to work, trying to raise children, trying to keep enough money so that they can educate those children. And you forget about all that and think of them as some sort of icon of Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley. And, of course, the minute Marie Curie died, she became that icon as well. And that's why it was so great to get her letters and her diaries and her workbooks, where you see a real woman who had a wonderful life, but also a tragic and very difficult life.
We're speaking with Barbara Goldsmith. Her book is Obsessive Genius, The Inner World of Marie Curie. The story changes, of course, dramatically with what is called the defining moment in Marie Curie's life, or that's how her daughter Eve saw it, and that is with the tragic accident which occurs in Paris when Pierre is run over by a wagon and immediately killed at the age of 49. And Marie Curie, of course, has to go on from here. And you say that this is a story which we have not really well understood, maybe, until now.
Yes, because, you know, all the romantic stories and the movie that was made in, I believe, the early 40s with Greer Garson and Walter Pidgeon, they all concentrate on the Pierre-Marie love story. And a lot of scientists concentrate on only their discovery of radioactivity, radium, polonium. But she had an entire life after he died, and she did, I think, some of her most magnificent things. In spite of being excoriated for her affair and having her house stoned and everything when World War I came, she took Roentgen's discovery of X-ray, set up mobile X-ray equipment, and went out into the front lines and X-rayed the soldiers so that these surgeons would stop hacking off their legs and arms. She located where the shrapnel was, and she trained 150 women to do the exact same thing. Her own daughter, Irene, passed her 17th to 18th birthday in the very near the trenches on the front lines, operating this equipment all by herself.
Hmm. She goes on to win a second Nobel Prize. She also, after some persuasion, undertakes to teach in her late husband's place. And you make a striking observation about the very first lecture which she gave in 1906, with hundreds of people crowded into the hall to hear what Marie Curie would say. And you talk about how she began that lecture after a wave of ovation, no trace of emotion in her voice, and she simply picked up exactly where her husband's last lecture had left off.
And that is why people thought perhaps she was cold, and that is why when I read her workbook, she says, "Oh, Pierre, you know, I'm not quoting exactly. I gave a lecture today. It was wonderful to do this, but to do it in your place, I thought I would just collapse. It was so painful for me. I couldn't possibly do this, but I want your name to be remembered. And so I have to force myself to get out there, to look cool, and to do this." And then you see that it isn't just what Einstein said, cold as a herring, but there's a lot of pain. And that's why I love these diaries and workbooks.
Right. Marie Curie goes on, at least for some of these years of widowhood, working very closely with her daughter, Irene, who becomes the second woman to earn the Nobel Prize. and her daughter Eve becomes a very talented writer. So the Curie name lives on in some very, very striking ways on into a generation and actually the generation after that as well.
Yes, isn't that amazing? When I first started on this, I thought I would write a book called Generations of Genius. But her granddaughter, Elaine, said to me, "You can't write that because none of us were really geniuses except my grandmother." But Irene, working with her husband, Marie discovered natural radioactivity in the element polonium and in the element radium, but her daughter figured out how to do artificial radioactivity, how to induce radioactivity in atoms. And what her daughter Irene had done was split the atom, which led to the atom bomb, everything, atomic energy, everything we know today, but she couldn't interpret her own data. She didn't really understand that she had split the atom. She and Fermi and a lot of scientists thought they were just creating heavier elements. They didn't realize that, indeed, the atom was like a little barbell, and they stretch both ends of these barbells, and crack, the atom split.
Do I remember correctly, at some point in the book, you tell us that the word atom actually in its root is sort of referring to indivisibility.
Exactly, so
the concept of splitting an atom would be, to many, sort of an impossible concept, and yet there it is.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Another great scientist of that day, Ernest Rutherford, said, "We knew that the atom, at least we thought, was a gray little lead ball and could knock nothing inside the atom." And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth.
Hmm. It must give you great pleasure to play some part in helping the world to better understand this intriguing figure of Marie Curie. But I suppose in some respects, this is still a long process because the myth which has grown up around her is probably kind of an obstinate one.
I don't think so. Obsessive Genius, you know, The Inner World of Marie Curie, it's been jumping onto bestseller lists. It's sold in 8 languages. And I think people are hungry in this day and age to see a real person who's coping with real problems instead of, I think it's pretty dry to read this other stuff. I mean, I could barely get through it myself.
So the real story is much more compelling than the myth which has sprung up.
I certainly think so. And she was even greater than her myth, but in a very human way.
The book, again, is called Obsessive Genius, The Inner World of Marie Curie. It's published by W.W. Norton & Company. It includes fascinating photographs and diagrams and so on. It is fascinating in every single way. The author, Barbara Goldsmith. Barbara Goldsmith, I loved the book and really enjoyed speaking with you today about it on The Morning Show. I thank you so much.
I thank you. Bye.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, as we announced earlier, it will be Cheryl Hernandez, Executive Director of the Kenosha Literacy Council. We're going to be celebrating International Literacy Day. And Marcia Conant, a former staffer here at WGTD, is going to be joining us as well via the telephone. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the